Sienna, I kind of am the thing that's not like the others as far as the panel goes, but I feel pretty honored to have even been included. So I'm amazed at the work that you all are doing. I'm certainly going to address some of the challenges that Vietnam veterans face at the end of their lives, probably in a small part due to some of the things that you discussed. There's a woman, a neuropsychiatrist, I believe. Yeah, I'm not very good at that. There's a neuropsychiatrist at Mount Sinai in New York, Rachel Yehuda, I believe, who was studying the cortisol levels in Holocaust survivors as well as the cortisol levels in Vietnam veterans and found a correlation between their both having very low levels. You can have cortisol as a stress hormone, most of you, I'm sure everybody knows that. Too much, too little of it is a bad thing. If you have too little, it's probably a result of adrenal fatigue and not being able to produce it as effectively as before because you've been through so much stress and so much trauma. So the overarching theme sort of my discussion is how trauma affects us in lots of different ways and even through generations. And through generations a lot more quickly than we previously understood. What she found was that, obviously genetic mutations take decades and many generations to have any kind of effect. These effects were taking place pretty quickly because it was the cell's response to what was going on and the kind of phenomenon that happens with epigenetics. And the children of Holocaust survivors in this particular study were suffering the same amounts of stress as their parents had been. She also looked at women who had been pregnant during the 9/11 bombings, and I apologize for those of you who might have been in the previous presentation because I talked about this then, and who had had children after bombings, obviously. The ones who had been in their second and third trimesters the babies did not develop a specific enzyme in utero that was necessary for them to gain an optimal amount of birth weight. The ones who were in the first trimester actually did. Their bodies were able to compensate for it. And overall, the babies who were born to mothers who survived that tragedy had a much lower birth weight than the population at large. So it just kind of clarified for me how we think about trauma as more of a psychological effect and the things that happen to us every day, but then it also obviously has some physiological effects that we're only starting to become aware of. And I think probably what you were talking about as far as the chemicals that we're carrying around in our bodies or some of us are who've been exposed to them, and then the effects of the things that we've dropped and not gone back and cleaned up are having long-term effects on those populations. Trauma disables all of us from being able to be in the present moment. It helps us focus on the past and obsess about the past, and then obviously impedes us from experiencing the future. And so in end-of-life care, that's a pretty significant dynamic because you certainly are doing quite a bit of life review for the most part, just depending on the individual, but you also being present during that process is important to their suffering or release of suffering, as well as the peaceful transition that they make and the kinds of things that they come to acknowledge and are able to maybe patch up with their families or with themselves or with God or whoever. And so most of what I'll be talking about is anecdotal experience that I've had as an inpatient hospice unit nurse over the last 3 years. And notice some commonalities among Holocaust survivors, Vietnam veterans, and then few people who were involved, not involved, but who were civilians during the Yugoslav wars. I had also had a paradigm shift kind of in the last few weeks in that I had often, as I thought a lot of people did, believe that the incredible rate of suicides that happened in this country to veterans were committed by those who had seen combat, and that anybody who sees combat obviously experiences some amount of PTSD. I do believe that's true. It was just kind of shocking to me to know that it's not, in fact, those who have seen combat who are committing suicide, but it's the ones who enlist in the military and then do not get to get employed, or you know, are not deployed. And I, obviously, there are going to be some variations in that, but across the board, the 22 suicides that happen every day, majority of those are from individuals who don't get deployed, which I think says to us even the further ranging effects of war and militarism and what we are investing, how we are indoctrinating people and young people into being invested into that as a way of life. What she also, either also found in her studies was that she ran a clinic for Holocaust survivors, and she figured out pretty quickly that it wasn't the survivors themselves who were calling her, but their children. And so they were experiencing similar levels of anxiety and stress and trouble with coping skills that their parents had been. Their parents had experienced some kind of stress disorder, the offspring were obviously were three times more likely to also experience that a similar type of stress disorder. Whether that whether that's nature or nurture, it seems to me that it's probably a combination of those two things. So, what do we do with this? That's the question. In the inpatient unit, we mostly see individuals who whose symptoms can't be managed in the home, and that usually means either pain or respiratory distress, nausea and vomiting, or anxiety. A lot of times, the anxiety maybe begins to manifest itself. That's what we call terminal agitation. It's not going back. I hit the wrong part. I hit it. There's a way to get to this. Here's your starting right. This is going to be. Okay, there we go. Okay, and I'm sorry. I forgot that I don't have any financial relationships that are going to be affected by this. and then I also just wanted to briefly, you've probably all read this poem, but I had to explain it to my sister when she asked me what the presentation was about. The Death of the Ball Turret Gunner was written by Randall Jarrell in the 40s, I believe, and it was his kind of way of talking about, as far as I could understand it, how war and the witnessing that one has to do during that time really affects the innocence of the individuals who are involved. And it was probably one of the first pieces of poetry that I read in high school that had to do with war. And those are ball turret gunners sitting there in front of the plane. And let me get this right. Okay, so what can we do? In hospice palliative care, as in other aspects of healthcare, certainly we try our best to continue to grow and understand different kinds of cultural differences, values, beliefs, backgrounds, practices, especially because we know that this is a pretty seminal moment for most people's families, and those traditions take on, maybe if it's possible, take on a little bit more of a magnified importance. Because it's the memory that they're going to have left with, and it's the thing, you know, you start to focus on those kinds of things, rituals, when you're out of control of some other things. We look at communities and what their differences are as far as race, ethnicity, faith, traditions, low SES status, and educational background, possibly age, age and generation, as well as gender identity, sexual orientation, gender expression, the nativity and immigration experience, as well as the intellectual and developmental challenges. What I think we may not do quite as effectively as we can is go a little deeper into those things, as well as into the community of veterans and civilian victims of war, and ask them what kinds of experiences they've had that possibly would contribute to some of the challenges, physiologically and psychological, existential and spiritual, that come along with the death and dying process. Okay, this is just a picture along with a quote from Johnny Gaisgun to kind of describe, you know, kind of make the connection between how I, from a few discussions I've had with individuals who were veterans, and the futility sort of that they faced or felt at the ends of their lives, and how you feel pretty inept trying to explain to them that, you know, they weren't futile and they had given it their all, and whether it was for something that they still agree with, they did the best they could. Okay, so some of the experiences that we notice among different kinds of communities who have been involved in war. World War II veterans seem to be a little more stoic, if I had to make a stereotype. They have either a tolerance, a denial, or an inability to identify their pain, and are not necessarily as willing as some other groups, and these are all stereotypes, of course, to take pain medication. Terminal agitation a lot of times is mistaken for maybe a history of mental illness, and I think we could go a lot farther into looking beyond maybe just the most recent history and physical of an individual, and seeing what kinds of things might have happened that aren't impacting this very recent admission and embracement of hospice care. Obviously, there's a lot of existential stress that stems from hospice experience, and violence and trauma, and you know, there are times that they wake up, obviously, just like all of us do, and have kind of relived those experiences in their dreams and visions. Unfinished business maybe. I think I noticed that a little bit more, probably a whole lot more of Vietnam vets, because of the shameful way that they came back and how they were treated, and you know, what they've had to do to cope, and also the judgments that are made about whether those judgments have any detail to back them up or not, about you know possibility of illicit drug use and alcoholism and those kinds of things. Hallucinations and flashbacks are pretty common. And then again, with certain vets' experience with opiates, antipsychotics, and anxiolytics. And then certain generation, which are usually World War II and older, are pretty resistant to taking morphine. We also have to respect that there's an importance of autonomy that may be even stronger with somebody who's fought in the military and who, you know, kind of probably was needing to call on as much autonomy as they had in any other part of their lives, and that needs to be respected. And then also the idea of complicated grief, kind of arising from having witnessed violence, death, as well as how difficult it was to assimilate back into this culture after their service ended. This is a picture of the Hiroshima Peace Memorial, and this is the atomic bomb dome. I chose it because I think the title said something about a shell, and it made me start thinking about how a shell can be a skeleton versus something protective versus something that we drop on somebody to kill them. So it kind of has a complicated metaphor. The historical impact of war has been affected by the global effects of World War I, obviously, and then the Holocaust survivors, the atomic bombings in Japan of World War II, the internment of the Japanese Americans, as well as the U.S. occupations of Germany, Austria, and Japan. Sorry. And that's my finished. also the Korean War, Vietnam, and we've talked about those. We've also had quite a few patients who had either witnessed or just lived there and then emigrated after the dissolution of Yugoslavia and those ethnic conflicts and the insurgencies that took place that we have a really hard time, I think, knowing what to do about. I want to skip down then and talk about or just mention that also the ongoing kind of threat of being involved with Libya, Syria, and Gaza, keeps us in a state of anxiety for those of us who see the, the travesty of continuing to solve problems as well. Okay, and then civilian victims of war, we do a lot of education, especially with Russian immigrants, Polish immigrants, and Jewish, those of the Jewish faith, about nutrition and hydration. It has not only to do with that's the way that we care for each other and the way that we feel like we're nurturing and doing the right thing, and it's what we've been doing all of our lives for each other, but also because of the time that they spent not having those available to them and really suffering physically from not being well hydrated and having a good diet. A lot of families are resistant to discussing the time before, especially with World War II vets. Then the decades-long grief that a lot of them experience and whether it was for refuge, where they chose to immigrate, I think has a pretty significant impact. The silence, I think, is even louder than talking about it most of the time, although, you can obviously get into some pretty intense discussions if someone stops being silent all of a sudden and they decide that, the day before somebody dies is the time to do that. And then the philosophical differences between members of the family who vary in the extent which they've had to assimilate or acculturate to this culture, and a lot of times that has to do with the generational differences of someone young who was born here as opposed to somebody who spent their life, spent the first half of their life there. Then I chose this poem by Mary Oliver just to, I guess, emphasize that sometimes it's what we do have to do is let it go, and that doesn't just come automatically and it doesn't come very easily, and it takes a lot of work, there's not really anything else that I can say about this, just that especially for those people who resist talking about their experience, I think they hold on to a lot that makes the very end of life process maybe a little harder, and it makes their family struggle with why are they lingering, why do all the physiological things point to the fact that they should have been dead 3 days ago and they are still here. There's something holding them here that's greater than what's going on physiologically with them. It becomes a whole lot more complicated. Then, to deal with the, what can we do for individuals to deal with the moral paradox of war, the notion of a good death, which, I may or may not agree with that. You can ask about their life experiences just beyond the history and physical. We don't ask individuals if they have PTSD. We ask them if they're veterans. We drape a flag over their body when they leave the unit, which is a very touching tribute and I think a wonderful thing, and we try to talk to them, and their families and acknowledge their service, but I think we could go beyond that to help those who are really struggling before they die, instead of just honoring them after they die. Identify previous losses, address again complicated grief, and acknowledge variations in sufferings and the effect of trauma. And I can skip to the end if you'd like. There's more. We're just of this kind of stuff, Bob. Are we pretty close? Okay. Trust is a big deal, especially with veterans, and so we have to be pretty sensitive to that. Just on a practical level in an acute care setting, it's pretty important, obviously, not to walk into the room and startle somebody. Especially if there's a possibility that they've didn't even necessarily have PTSD, but certainly have had lots of experiences where they've been scared and had to worry about what was going on from minute to minute. Also respect their need for autonomy, but also but offer them the possibility of presence and community from others, especially if they've been estranged from their families, but also balance that with their need for sometimes needing to be alone, private, and resting, and then honor dignity, and just be as present as possible when they're going through those life reviews and explaining some of the things that maybe do occasionally finally start to seep out. And just don't assume that you know something, even if somebody is a World War II vet, and you know, I have all these characteristics, and I try not to go in and say, okay, this guy's not going to want to take any pain medicine, or this person is going to want to feed and provide all kinds of fluids, and it's going to take a long time for the education to happen, because you just have to start with where they are, and you know, none of this fits into the stereotypes that a lot of other people put us into. And then some just real practical things. It seems to me we could do PTSD screenings upon admission to hospice. We could investigate the other mental health challenges relative to their war experience and whatever vulnerabilities may have resulted from those. We could provide more evidence-based mental health support from professionals whose expertise is in the effects of trauma. I don't feel comfortable, I can answer some questions and can listen, but I'm not the one who should be doing that. ask more specific questions about their veteran status, and for those who aren't veterans but might be immigrants or children of immigrants, ask about their experience of war and conflict. And then just emphasize their roles, their life review, their connectedness, and just try to do whatever you can to give them as much quality of life leading up to the death and a more peaceful dying process. And then these are some pictures of that just to me kind of said a little bit more about other cultures and countries being able to forgive and heal a little more effectively than we do with some Palestinian boys and men up in the right corner, lanterns, planters commemorating the bombing of Hiroshima, and then the Jewish Hall of Names at the Holocaust Memorial. The Jerusalem, I'm sorry, Hall of Names at the Holocaust Memorial. And then this is just a quote that kind of sums up why I did this and why I keep doing what I do, which is just that I think there's always a little bit of light somewhere, and we've got to try to find it. And do whatever we can to do that. So that's it. Thank you very much. I appreciate you listening.
Thank you, Stephanie. Well, we'll open it up for questions. I actually had one question that was provoked by the first sessions, and it's probably because I'm doing work in reproductive health, and the issues that were brought up. I mean, we're always talking here that breast milk is best, and even in the United States, so many women have very high levels of chemical pollutants in the breast milk. We always say that the benefits of breast milk outweigh that. But some of the levels that you were reporting on TCDD in breast milk of women in these impacted areas are quite astounding. And I just wonder if that's come up for any discussion in Vietnam. You can come up to the...
I think when people have actually done the looked at sort of the risk benefit and balance of breast milk, even though breast milk lactating is a great route of excretion for these very lipophilic compounds. In general, the consensus is that it's the benefits of breastfeeding outweigh the risks coming from the chemical exposures. The levels I showed you were from 1970, okay. So those are historical levels. So hopefully we aren't in that realm anymore, and I actually don't think we are. I mean, those may very well be some of the highest levels ever recorded. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Trish?
Yeah. So two questions. One about the lingering effects of arsenic in the rice. And the other, yes. In your first question, it's really, I mean, for a long time, relations with Vietnam were not that great, and so it was not, the Vietnamese didn't really have the tools to do the epidemiology, and so at this point, it's very complicated because, there are possible collaborations. There's certainly Vietnamese that are able to do it, but now the time has passed. So it's not a simple thing to put forward. And just in terms of resources, in terms of funding, and people have moved around. We've kind of looked at it over the years, like what piece you could take away from it, and actually do a structured study that really, where you're really studying what you think you are studying. And it's not easy. As for the second one, I don't have a good answer for you on that, because I don't know if people have done market basket surveys, just looking at levels in rice after this time. A lot of the South was sprayed with Agent Blue, and that's one of the big unknowns as well. So
I don't have any more definitive.
Yeah.
Other questions or comments from the panel?
Could I mention?
Yeah, why don't you come up here though?
Please don't leave without getting our card on full disclosure toward an honest commemoration of the American War in Vietnam. Please look at our website. It has enormous amounts of information. There are teaching guides that you can use in high school and college to talk the truth about what happened in Southeast Asia. And I want to make sure that you all have a copy of this. Part of the reason that several of us are on the program is to be able to inform the public about what the United States did, in fact, in Southeast Asia, and how that same pattern of behavior continues throughout the world. I also wanted to quickly mention to you that one of the issues that we deal with as veterans is the issue that has been pathologized by the Veterans Administration and psychiatry, that we call post-traumatic stress a disorder. Veterans say, come on now, it is a normal reaction to an abnormal situation. And I'm so sorry that I forgot to mention the issue of moral injury. Moral injury that happens when an individual is forced to do something that is against his moral compass. It is a matter of survival. It is a matter of keeping his buddies alive. But this is done. He or she does this and lives with this the rest of their lives. It's either post-traumatic stress, which is a pathologized reason for calling somebody post-traumatic stress disorder. Moral injury explains the phenomenon in political terms as well as personal and psychological terms. So please think of it that way. And just, I wanted to quickly add on to the issue about the suicide rate. When we look at the 22 veterans today, we're looking at all ages. It's not simply a certain generation. There's a number of different generations represented.
And if you look at the most recent study of suicide rate among American female veterans, it is twice that among the male veterans. And it's an extraordinarily high number because women in this society do not kill themselves, just do not commit suicide. So we are having, as was mentioned earlier, an extraordinary impact on the militarization of this society, on all people. Thank you.